The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
And say, look, I'm writing a term paper on your article, you know. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Because when it comes to engineering ethics, there's about if it's strictly engineering ethics, as opposed to other kinds of, the more general ethics, there's a 90% chance that I will know the author of who you're talking about, tell you a little bit where they're coming from, and invite you to call them. Okay, we got a good day today. What I'd like to do is to, I'm giving your papers back. What I'd like to do is to review the papers, but I want your permission. What I want to do is to make an anonymous review, but I want to make it public. I want to read it out to everybody. Nobody will know who said what.
There's only two of us.
Well, they don't know which one of you. I tell you what, it's not...
It doesn't matter. I don't care.
Well, let's see how it goes. There's nothing in here that's going to...
No.
That I have to say that's going to be, you know... Anything that's, well, let me use some judgment and see how it goes. And okay. Now what I want you to do is the grade that I have put down here, is not the grade for the paper you gave. The grade that I put down here is for your second draft that will respond to my comments. And that you can save. You don't give back to me, but you can save, but you can talk to me about it, okay, as we go along. In other words, I said at the beginning of class, I want to see improvement. All right. So I want you to feel like you can doctor this thing up a little bit. Okay, I marked good in several cases on both papers not because you made good observations, which you did, and good thoughts, gave me some good thoughts. But I was actually surprised, positively surprised by the good thoughts that both of you had put in here. But it was little things like that you did get a reference that I had not brought in, and you did it on your own. That was good. Okay, and for example, I didn't make a distinction between act and rule utilitarianism, and you all figure that out. Okay. That's the kind of stuff I'm looking for. Another one is an anomaly that's just in the field. Let me give you something to remember that will cause you to remember it. It's a little game that you can play with 3-year-olds. You ever play? Y'all play around with kids? 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds. Okay. It's a little game. But it is very, my experience with telling it, with playing this game with these little kids is very, very interesting. And that is, you say, what has a big head, red eyes, and eats rocks? Kid says, I don't know. You say, a big-headed, red-eyed rock eater. Kid says, okay. Then you say, what has a big head, yellow eyes? At each rocks. And the kid says, a big-headed, yellow-eyed rock eater. You say, no, they only come in red. Now, my experience is that 4-year-olds will see the point to that. It's just the way life is. Okay? All right? Now, in ethics, you'll find a lot of this. You'll find deontological ethics, but very few people, not a lot of people, talk about ontological ethics. Don't be bothered by that. Okay. And there'll be a lot of those. There'll be a lot of... let me see if I can think of another one. They'll talk about consequentialist and non-consequentialist. But there's another one. I'll think of it before the class is over. But there are a lot of these little anomalies. Just don't let them bother you, but pick them up. Okay, another thing is that this case is more properly called the A7D case than the A7 case. It's the nomenclature for the break. Here's a very significant teaching point. Very significant teaching point for this kind of class. On the one hand, a prescription for behavior is made more compelling, I agree, if you use two very different approaches and come up with the same prescription. Now, that's very compelling. But in ethics, there's no reason that two prescriptions should be the same. If you get different prescriptions, you don't have to say you need more work. That's the way it can end. Okay? What you're really looking for is the defensibility of it. So I could give you a classic case, one that I think you should think over, and probably one that you've thought over before. It doesn't have a name. But you've seen it in movies. A ship sinks. Some people escape in a lifeboat. There are 10 people in the lifeboat. There's food enough for 10 people for a week, but they don't expect to be picked up for a month. Okay. Well, you can come up with a whole lot of solutions that are very different, even opposite. And all of them are equally defensible. You can come up with some solutions. You can come up with a solution that is defensible. I can come up with the same solution that is not defensible. Okay? All right. So in an engineering class, let's put it this way. In undergraduate engineering, there is such a thing as the answer in the back of the book. The operative word is the. Okay. In graduate, you're going to find you can get more than one answer, and there's cost and benefits on either side. Out there, a lot of good answers, a lot of bad answers. And what is going to count most in many situations is like it is here. It's your argument. And that's going to be because, and this is one thing that I try to direct my class to, because people just will not know, no matter what you say, what the right answer is. The question, let me tell you a story. I got another story. Let me just tell this story. I'm a young assistant professor. And I'm down there, and I go down to NASA Langley Research Center. This is in Hampton, Virginia. Know about it?
I worked there.
Oh.
two summer internships.
Really? What division?
The spacecraft and sensors branch. So, yeah, in the building where the Mercury astronauts were trained.
Whoa. I was down there in the late 70s and almost all through the 80s. I had grants with them for about 12 years. And I had a relationship down there where I was going down there so often that what I'd do is rent a house. I'd take students with me. We live in the house, work. And I did that 8 or 9 years, I guess. And so we would all get in the car and ride down there, and I had this little speech I'd give. And I was unmarried at the time, and I would tell them that whatever happens in Hampton stays in Hampton. I don't want any students coming back to Howard saying, I saw Dr. Broom. I said, whatever happens down there stays down there. So 1 year, we were riding down there. I was riding down there with three students. And I made my little speech. They agreed with it. And then one of them said, does that go for us too? And I had thought, there's never a case where I go back to Howard and tell what students did. I don't care what they did. I just don't do it. And so I said, yeah, I guess it goes for you too. So they started lighting up these reefers. And I said, oh, my God, what have I got myself into? Then the police came. It was because they were speeding. And and there's a place in Virginia, I'm going to tell you right now, I can't think of it right. But there's a place in Virginia where if the police get you for speeding, they don't give you a ticket on the spot. They take you about 10 miles off the road to a special place where you have to fill out a form and you have to pay in cash. They took us off. I said, I know I'm going to jail. That was 30 years ago. But we got that. The story is that one day I went to what's called a division meeting. This was the Structures and Dynamics Division. And I had to go to all of the division meetings. And it got mean-spirited in there that day. So you imagine a room, and there's about 100 engineers, 95 of them have PhDs. They called the place a campus when I was there. And these engineers were up making a presentation, and the chief was sitting on the side and started quizzing them about it. And it got mean in there. And he hit his hand fist on the table, and it kept going round and round. And so that was my first meeting, I think. And I said, my God, if I have to make a presentation in here, I'm just going to have to be ready. Because it was awful. Awful is the word. Okay. So after that, it was lunchtime. Went to the cafeteria. And this man sat at this long table after he got his tray, sat at this long table, and nobody sat with him at that table. Not from the division, not from any place else. Everybody went someplace else and said, he's sitting over there by himself. So I came up with my tray and I said, look, I said, you mind some company? No, he said, no. And so I said, well, I'm down here just for, as you know, just for the summer. Maybe next summer too, but I said, this is an opportunity for me to learn something. I said, this is a pretty mean meeting you just had. And I said to him, not only that, but let's call a spade a spade. I said, all those PhDs in there that you are tearing up, and you don't even hold a PhD. You have a master's from MIT. I said, how do you know when they're right or when they're wrong? And he said, being right or wrong is not the issue. He said, it's a question of commitment. What are they willing to put their careers on? He said, so I put the heat on them. And what I'm looking for is, number one, whether or not they're going to stand by what they said or whether they're going to start backpedaling. And number two, whether anybody sitting out there is going to join them. Or be glad it's not them. He said, you watched them. He said, I put them under pressure. After a while, they started backpedaling. And nobody came to their aid. So we're not going with those results. Yeah, they're probably right. But no, we're not going with that. He said, if they stood up to me, he said, this is a government. They know there's going to be a rift coming around in a year or so. Okay. He said, I'm going to fire them. He said, but look, he said, if they had stood up to me, and if a couple of them out of the audience stood up and stood with them, he said, that's what we're going to go with. The thing might go up and come back down, explode. He said, but that's the business we're in. This is the real world of engineering. It's the commitment that counts. And we got good people out here. And if they are willing to commit, then the United States will say, when the thing goes up and explodes, they will say, here's some more money, try it again. But if we having the right answers is not the whole story, not even the main story, when you particularly talking about space, where you don't have a tradition. Everything you're doing is for the first time. Okay, so that's the real world. Now, the good news is, the bad news is that undergraduate education is not like that. Semi depends on who your major professor is. Graduate education is not like that in engineering. But from day one, ethics education is like that. Because we want a good answer now. Don't get me wrong. Okay, but it's that argument up to it. And whether or not, as I'm grading it, and as any other professor would grade it, whether or not I would commit me and my kids to your answer. To your analysis, because my kids are going to have to cross that bridge. Okay, and so I'm interested that you got everything written down, but there's got to be something under it that's compelling, and that is impossible to grade. But I can tell you whether or not it's there. I can tell you whether or not I feel it, and most importantly, even if I don't feel it, I've been out here long enough to know whether somebody else will. I would say, yeah, there's some people out here that would really feel this. Okay. But that takes time. My objective in this class is not to meet that objective. It's the first time you've had an engineering ethics course. And if this was a sequence, then I would expect it the next time. It's my objective in this class to talk about it. Okay. Let's see. Yes, a few comments. Immanuel Kant takes his categorical imperative and states it three or four different ways. Now, I think you all picked that up. There's a subtlety in one of them. The golden rule is one of those statements. So tie that in to Kant. He explicitly says that the golden rule is a legitimate statement of the categorical imperative. Now, so what that means is that out of the different formulations of his categorical imperative, you can pick any one of them. I'm not too sure that a philosopher would say that one is better than the other, just different ways of stating the thing properly, because it's a complicated sort of thing. I guess you all know which one is my preference, treating people as means to ends. That's my preference. The first one is a little bit convoluted. Frankly, I like it because he's really saying what I think he really means, and that is he's trying to connect his categorical imperative to first principles of logic. Right. So that's important to you. I think the main importance of that to you is that now you can see what counts as a fundamental idea as opposed to a theory that's incremental. You can now say that, well, now I know what the Nobel, if there was a Nobel Prize for philosophy, which there isn't, even though philosophers have gotten Nobel Prizes. For what?
For peace.
I think maybe you can count some of them, all of them who got it for peace were philosophers or doing philosophy, even some of the chemists who did it. But Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, from Sartre, mm-hmm. was a philosopher. He got it, and some others, but they got it for literature.
Right.
But they were doing philosophy in the literature.
Yeah.
And Sartre, I think is the way a Frenchman would pronounce it. I think I can get away with saying Sartre. Is someone that I would like to cover. Okay. We can read. The good thing about doing Sartre is that his plays, you can read his plays overnight. They're real short. and we can talk about one or two of them. But he is, Sartre is a Frenchman. He's in a different category. He's going to tell you things just by what I just did. He's going to tell a story. Out of that, you've got to synthesize what the message is. Okay, that's good. Let's see if I can make some more.
Professor Broom, so there are three ways to look at it. If we're doing an analysis, I know we probably won't have an assignment like we do where we're specifically told to take this approach, but is it okay just to choose our favorite and pick one, and in theory, should they all come to the same conclusion?
There's no reason that they should all come to the same conclusion.
Okay, so we could phrase it in a different way and come up with something completely different depending on which interpretation we like or choose to use or think is most appropriate.
What I hope is that you have enough experiences in this class that you will find that you can come up with two opposite, even, conclusions that are well-grounded.
So, and we should write about both of them and have the same defensibility for both of them.
Okay, you're putting me in...
My question is, you know, because you talked about wanting to have the passion behind the conclusion.
Yeah.
Does that mean we should only write about the approach that gives us that passion
No.
in that argument? No.
No.
Okay.
Because this thing takes time.
Okay.
Okay, it takes time. This is going to be an assignment that I'm going to make before the class is over. The most important thing, not the most important thing, but what I'm going to take out of it today is something that the office says early on, right at the end of his preface. No, he calls it foreword, right at the end of his foreword. This is Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parsifal. Okay. It's part of the Arthurian mythology.
Yeah.
But this is a German who's writing it. And you're probably most familiar with Thomas Malory's, what's called Mort d'Arthur, King Arthur's story, you know, and Guinevere. All of that. You're probably most familiar with that. They are pretty much different versions of the same story. Okay, they're different, and you'll find many of the same characters in these stories. Both the translators of both of the ones that I have, this one and the one of Mort d'Arthur. Start out by telling you that, well, I could translate this thing back into plain English, but I won't. Just a few things. Yeah. Says, because if you just read it in the vernacular of the time, that after a while, maybe page 30, maybe page 50, it'll sound right. And you've already had that experience, Shakespeare. You read Shakespeare's, but you would like them, you would, the first time you read it, you would say, good God, why didn't the teacher give me plain English Shakespeare? Mm-hmm. Well, if they gave you Shakespeare, then after a while, something magic happens. The stuff sounds like, you know, you feel like you've learned a language, right? Something happens, and that's what happens. That took that long explanation to come back to tell you that that's what happens in this kind of course. You're learning something very new, and it'll take you a while to get in the rhythm of it, all right? Particularly with complexities. After a while, you'll say, well, yeah, it is complex, but I sort of see a way through this. Let's see, many of the comments I had were pretty much the same. Another issue is with the utilitarian approach. It's a little bit forgiving in terms of your being able to predict consequences. you don't have to be exact in this. Even if you read Stuart Millenden, what they're saying is your best judgment at the time. So you make your judgment at the time. You don't have to take into, you know, see, that's what really comes into account with engineering. You're going to build a bridge. You're going to build that bridge for a life of 100 years. Now you're supposed to tell me what the consequences are to everybody who crosses that bridge? You got to make some kind of judgment, reasonable judgment, that is not so much defensible as it is, I'm going to use the term, committable. You think that other people will say, yeah, we'll go along with this. And that's why there's when it comes to engineering, you won't find this in many of the texts. I don't think you'll find it in any of them, frankly. But I'll tell you right now, which is one of the most compelling rationales an engineer can give for doing X as opposed to Y, that works almost, if it applies, works almost all the time. We always do it that way. Tradition. Okay, so you got a citizen group in here, and they want to know why you want to put the nuclear waste dump over there as opposed to over there. And then you come up with some kind of a formula, and they don't understand the formula. And they're mad about it. Okay. If you are able to tell them rightly, and all the other engineers in the room go along with it, that formula is what we always use, you're going to go a long way with that. Scientists can't get away with that. Because there's always a formula that's better than the old ones. But engineers, tradition is a good one. And you can use that in ethics. Okay, let's see. Lastly, the story terms. I'm going to leave that one to more discussion as we go along the class because I plan to do more of that. So when you do your draft 2, and I'm going to ask you to make draft 2 a copy of draft 1 so that you can look back and see your progress. Don't edit draft 1. So as time goes along, see if you will go back and change anything you said about the story terms. Okay. Okay, did I step on anybody's toes? Any comments, questions? This was their homework. Okay, let's do some unfinished. Well, let me give you more time. Unfinished business and then new business. Better stated, since you all love parliamentary procedure so much. You have experience with parliamentary bodies?
Not much. I think high school, student council was the
most. Maybe we should do more. I was chair of the faculty senate at Howard for 6 years. Now, senates are usually, at universities, either a senate, a committee of the faculty that does certain things and represents the faculty to the president. At Howard, the Senate is a consists of all of the faculty, all the full-time faculty. And it also consists of the president and the deans as ex officio members without vote. And it, the Senate, all of its committees and all of its meetings are presided over by a faculty person. And the Senate reports to the Board of Trustees through the president. So they give the document to the president, and the president is compelled to give it to the board. Now the president can decide how to give it to the board. Okay. But nevertheless, that's the way it operates. The point I'm trying to make is that try to imagine an engineer with the gavel, parliamentary procedure, at a university where you got a law school, a department of business, and I tell you, the hardest ones to preside over. We got a medical school, the surgeons. Every surgeon knows exactly the way he or she knows it's got to go, and you can't tell them one way or another. The lawyers, there's a way to deal with them. Well, they operate with the law just a lot like they do with ethics. If one lawyer believes A, another one believes B. So when the one that's believing A is tearing you up, find one that that will use approach B. Right. So now you're beginning to see what the connection that I am going to make, and that is between law and ethics. That there's a whole lot of connection. And depending on what country you're in, on what country you're in, you may find that there's no difference between law and ethics. You may go to the Middle East and the judges have on clerical outfits with the Quran in front of them, and they don't see any difference between law, ethics, and religion. No difference. It's all the same. Okay, so where was I? Oh, we don't want to do old business.
Right.
Unfinished business. What were we doing last? I don't think we finished it.
We started talking about Ford Pinto.
Ford Pinto. Now, there's something I think is unfinished about that, about our discussion on that. We talked about Ford, but we didn't talk about any persons. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to put the question to you. First, let me put an observation to you, that in law, a corporation has the status of a person. So that means a corporation can commit a crime. A corporation can be punished for the crime, even though nobody in the corporation has been found guilty of committing any crime. Okay, we agree on that? If you find a better, sharper statement, then bring it in next class, and we'll amend it, what I just said. Okay. When engineering ethics was really invented back in the early 70s, did I give you a history of engineering ethics yet? Or the STS movement?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Then one of the there were two great hopes of the scholars, mainly the philosophers, in it. One great hope was that someone would be able to discover a new ethic. Maybe from a utilitarian variety, maybe from a categorical or deontological variety, maybe a new variety. But a lot of people thought they would be able to find a new ethic. I'm not so sure that they did.
Meaning a new moral standard on which to base decisions?
Yeah. And actually, they did. I'll tell you about one or two that I think they might have done, or we might have done. So that was one of the great hopes. Another great hope was to be able to give a corporation moral agency. that the hope was to be able to say that a corporation did the wrong thing. And there was this paper that was written by one of the, I'll call him out, one of the giants in the field. His name is John Ladd, L-A-D-D. John Ladd is in semi-retirement. He's, I guess he's about 80 now. But he's still active, still writes, still comes to meetings. John Ladd wrote this paper, and what it said was that there's nothing in any moral tradition that would allow the assignment of moral agency to a corporation. As a matter of fact, he said, there's only one assignment that you can make to a group as opposed to an individual. You want to take a wild guess as to what group that is? A collection of persons that has moral, that has moral agency, a collection as opposed to an individual. If you make a wild guess, you'll probably be right.
Pardon?
Nope. That's a good one because you would think that because of the hierarchical arrangement there. No. Family. Because the kids, the parents are responsible for what, morally responsible for the kids' moral behavior, he argued. And I don't remember anybody arguing back on it. Now, this is John Ladd talking. Okay. If you ever decide to do anything with John Ladd, I can give you his phone number. I have to look it up, but I got it. I got his home phone number, too. You can call him up. He'd really like to talk to you. Okay. So that pretty much killed it, that corporations could not have moral agency. Now, I'm going to talk about a way to make a corporation have moral agency, but it's going to be new, but I'm going to put that towards the end of the course. All right. When we talked about the Ford Pinto case, I remember us talking a lot about Ford and the Ford Pinto, but I don't remember us talking about individuals. Were there any individual behaviors in there that we should discuss? And then characterize that behavior as either moral, immoral, ethical, or unethical. Any difference between moral and morals and ethics? Ooh. See, that's one thing that is typical of this course. Typically, you get halfway through the course before somebody will define what the course means. Okay, that's not unusual at all. But it's about time for us to get a little sophisticated about those two words. Okay, so I'll give you a chance to look them up first, and then I'll tell you what's going on. Are there any individuals that we need to talk about in this Ford Pinto case? Did they name any, or they just talk about engineers generally?
They do name, in our little blurb, name Eckold, the director of automotive safety for Ford.
Yeah, what did they say about Eckold?
He is the one who actually issued the study with the cost-benefit analysis, concluding that it was more costly to add in the safety feature.
Okay.
So he's one character.
Yeah.
I would say another one that's not mentioned in the article is Iacocca, right?
Yes.
Who said we need to make a vehicle that's less than $2,000 and less than $2,000. You got to do it.
Okay. Lee Iacocca, interestingly enough, after that, I think you all probably know better than I, became quite a corporate hero in America.
Eccles.
Now, what do you think Eccles would say? If Eccles came in here, what do you think Eccles would say, how he would say, would he defend what he did? And could you defend what he did? And could you consider criticize what he did? And you can play devil's advocate. You can give me both arguments.
assume he would defend what he did, saying that it was the cost-benefit analysis, which assigns a cost to human life, is legitimate, and it's a practice used.
It's tradition.
By engineers and engineering managers in deciding whether a risk is acceptable.
All right, let's play a game. Suppose I'm Eccles, and I hire you not as my lawyer, but as my ethicist. And I'm going before before an ethical review, and you've got to present my case. Two of y'all. And you got to ground this. Just can't say, give me an opinion. How would you ground it?
I would probably ground it in the fact that managers, that is their responsibility. Like, I think we discussed this a little bit last time, to worry about money. As a manager, that's my ethical responsibility. To conduct a study that is going to accurately tell you how this is going to affect the company's finances.
Okay, so how can you justify it? What is that your personal theory, or is there some theory out here you can reference? Well, you can probably use something of a Kantian nature, not exactly Kant, but talk about a contract. Do you have an obligation? That's a principle. Is there a principle that you have to live up to your contract?
That is the contract that I have with the company when I took this job. That was the contract. I'm worrying about money, bottom line, making this thing work. And that is my contract.
Okay. Now, we have to worry that after you've said that there's an opposing point of view that's going to give a different answer.
Oh, yeah.
Utilitarian. And that the interesting part about that is that your customers are most likely going to use utilitarian because that affects them. That's the way they're going to see it. Okay, so probably Eccles or somebody in Eccles' position would typically say what you just said, but would say add something to it. We've already said this in the class. We've already seen it. And that is that the ethical responsibility beyond that is at a higher level. Okay. Now, let me give you something that will come into play once you say that. That I've done my job, the utilitarian responsibility is at the higher level. Okay, let's play that again. My job is deontological. I have a principle. Live up to my contracts. I made a deal. The contract was legal.
Wait, what role are you playing now?
I don't know which role. I'm playing Eccles' role.
Okay, and what's the contract?
The contract is my job description. Which has legal force because the corporation is incorporated. That is, there exists a contract between the entity and society. Right. So you can play that game straight down the line. There's a contract between the entity and society in the articles of incorporation. And that is a hierarchical organization, and my position in the hierarchy has a name and a responsibility or a mission. And to live up to that principle, I have to live up to that mission.
Okay.
Right again? Now, to break a contract, we're in the gray area between ethics and law. And if we shift too much to the law area, you'll know it because I won't know what I'm talking about. Okay. But I do know that to break a contract, both parties to the contract have to agree to break. Unless you break a leg or something like that. But it takes some agreement. So your point is going to be included in what I'm about to say. I don't know if this is in this particular textbook or not, but it's something that's in probably enough engineering ethics textbooks, or in enough ethics textbooks, or in enough textbooks on science, scientific ethics, which is mostly research ethics, that this is this is something you have to know. It's called the Nuremberg Principle. Anybody want to give a lecture? All right. Nuremberg, the Nuremberg trials, that's where it comes from. That, now this is interesting. Try to read some law. I try to read law because I have to argue with lawyers at dinner all the time on weekends. I just found, when my wife and I go out with friends, a third of them are lawyers and a third of them are psychiatrists. The other third, very. But I don't defend myself against the psychiatrist. And it just was very strange that my wife's first husband is a psychiatrist. But all of these other psychiatrists are friends that I had before I met him. And I guess they like practicing on me, the psychiatrist. But that's significant because when we talk about the Nuremberg Principle, there's some really fundamental stuff in there about the law that is taken directly from ethics. So there's two kinds of law. Anybody know lawyers? Hang out with lawyers? Okay. You should sometime. You get them to talk. I mean, if you can stop them from talking, but. There are two kinds of law. One is called natural law. And the other one is, I'm trying to think of the name, it's not exactly scientific law. What's the other one called? I get these names. I wasn't prepared to talk about this today, but now that it's come up, I'm going to go through it and then we'll amend it next class or add to it or whatever we need to. But look up the other kind. The natural law basically says that law and ethics, law should never disobey ethical principles, should always be supported by ethical principles. Most law that's done in the United States is not natural law. Okay. But both came up in the Nuremberg Principle. Now, what happened in the Nuremberg Principle was that the defendants were Nazis, big Nazis, and their basic defense was that they were following orders, that in their country, it's almost the same thing we're talking about now with Ford. That the government had a responsibility to the people, and that there was a hierarchy, and that if anybody at the top did something that was morally wrong, then punish him. The rest of us were doing what we were legally required to do. What they said, and what happened was, in the end, what happened was that they wound up into a quandary because the West wanted to say that what they had done was to commit a crime against humanity, of which each person in the hierarchy was responsible. and defense. And not all of the defendants had the same lawyer. There was this one lawyer. As a matter of fact, if you see this movement, this movie called Judgment at Nuremberg, the lawyer was played by Max. Anybody remember his last name? Lawyer. He got the Academy Award that year for Best Supporting Actor. Okay. The lawyer that said, yes, they were not only following their orders, but yes, they committed, each one of them, a crime against humanity. Then he came up with a brilliant remark to that. You can't punish a person for breaking a law that you just made. At the time they did it, there was no law called crime against humanity. So what the West finally did was they came up with all of these films from the concentration camps and used those films pretty much like the O.J. case. Just bear down on public opinion. So that what they did in the end, they got pretty much support from the rest of the world. Okay. But that's the way that thing came down. It came down. Check the spelling on this. I had not prepared for this, but it's called My Lai. It was in Vietnam. It was a Vietnam case where American soldiers killed these civilians, men, women, and children. And Lieutenant Kelly said that he was merely following orders. And what the scholars did, I'm not going to talk about the law anymore. What the scholars did was they came back to the Nuremberg principle and said that an officer is responsible for what he or she does regardless of the orders. The sergeant and the rest of the men should follow orders. They divided the house. So now, if we apply this thinking to Ford, what we would tell Eccles is that being a professional employee as opposed to a technical or other kind of an employee, you are responsible for what you do, orders notwithstanding. All right, so now what I'm going to do is I just thought, rather than all of us just saying we'll revisit this the next time, I'm going to make a lighthearted assignment, and that is that you become familiar with the Nuremberg Principle, the Cali case, and see if you can apply it to the Ford Pinto case, and whatever corrections need to be made at the next class on anything that I said in this class or even the following class that we'll make that it'll be everybody's responsibility to get it right. Okay. But I think that I'm 99% on all of this. Yes. Which one? This one? This one? It's in a lot of movies.
Yeah, the one with Jack Nicholson from the military movie.
Jack Nicholson, you said? Tom, what's the name of it? A Few Good Men.
There was a trial there. And there was some, like, in Guantanamo.
Yes.
Oh, in Guantanamo.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So this people, then the sergeants or sailors just weren't on this. I think Japanese is not took it was for in the end, but the other guys also, even if they were falling out, they also took it.
Okay.
They didn't get off on the same place. And I think this idea is a lot of other military movements basically talks to the responsibility of the individual regardless of the origins from the world.
There was another one that I didn't see starring Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington, where Denzel is captain of this nuclear sub, and Hackman gives him the order to fire.
Yeah.
I don't know the name of that film.
I know
it's
I've seen it. I can't think of it.
Now, I guess you know I'm susceptible to talking about films in class. So if you see any of these films and you want to make a five-minute report on the film, that is legitimate for this class. Okay. That was another one. I'll tell you another one that goes back a little early for you all. When Ronald Reagan was president, there was a military event in the Red Sea. And Reagan came on national television and said that only he, as president, had the authority to order a military person in combat to use nuclear weapons. But he was delegating his authority in the Red Sea to ship captains. Now, I'll tell you why I remember that so well. Because when I saw him come on television and say that, I was in an airplane that was getting ready to land at Oran, which is on the Red Sea. I was on my way to China, and we were, actually, it was Dahrain. That's where I was going, Dahrain. And we were just about 20 minutes out before they said, prepare to land. And who can land? And I'm looking over there, looking at the Red Sea. My God, I said, am I going to be in a nuclear war? but I remember that. These situations are not I would like to call them real, but I think that they are real. More than realistic, if you can follow my meaning in that. What do you do when the delegation of authority goes down to ship commanders for a nuclear war, to launch a nuclear weapon in defense? Okay. Now you begin to talk about these issues. Somebody is responsible, no matter who gave them the authority. Okay, I think I'm happy with this discussion on the Ford Pinto.
Can I bring up one topic on it?
I'm going to bring up, I just thought of another topic I'm going to bring up on it. Go ahead. Actually, it's a story, not a topic.
Well, so I've been trying to find a way to say that the actions of Ford in producing and selling the Pintos is not morally. And what I came up with was to say that even though the utilitarian cost-benefit analysis said it was not worth it to add the safety feature and to sell the car, what they didn't think about was informed consent. So, like, right. They didn't respect the moral agency of the public to decide about the risk they were getting into. Is that an appropriate issue to bring into this case?
That's a good question. Now, Informed consent. I want y'all to know that term. Informed consent comes out of medical ethics, because now you're talking about your physician not only getting your consent for some kind of procedure, but the physician giving you some lessons on what you're doing. Now, a little bit of U.S. history. When I was a kid, you just did not criticize what a doctor said. Just totally unheard of. It was almost bordering on the religious. You just did not question your doctor. And getting a second opinion would have been would have been unthinkable. During the late 60s, that began to turn around. Mainly because now that everything I've said is empirically testable, I doubt if anybody would dispute what I just said. Now you might get a little dispute, but anybody who would dispute what I'm about to say would understand clearly what I'm saying and why I said it. And that is that things began to turn around when the women's movement began to give women more recognition for their responsibilities and thoughts and abilities, which meant that you now have women who had children and who are reading books about how to care for their children. They just weren't consulting the doctors. And if the doctor said something that they didn't believe, they'd consult another one. So out of that, you get the STS movement, and medical ethics then began to start talking about informed consent being a moral dimension to the relationship between physician and patient. Okay. Now, if you apply informed consent to engineering, you run into not a theoretical, but an applications problem. That in most cases, in utilitarianism, you can't find all of the affected parties. And informed consent is so easy because it's the patient or the patient's mother. Could be the patient's father too, but you see what I'm saying? We're talking about a role in the family that can be played by either male or female. All right. So informed consent then, all except for one case, well, not one case, but one case that I'm going to bring into class, and I'm not going to tell you which one it is, but I'm going to bring one into class. Informed consent in engineering usually gets diffused. Now, in this case that you bring, informed consent, how would you apply it to the Ford Pinto case?
Well, I mean, one option is that one of the engineers who knew of the test results, he knew that the car would explode, hit in a certain way, could at least write a memo to an authority that maybe wasn't being told about these things, like a higher manager, and hope that an action would be taken. And then if that didn't do anything, you know, contact a news agency and say, I want to blow the whistle on this car that's about to be put in production.
All right, now, I've never heard that argument applied to the Ford Pinto case. But what I'm saying is you're bringing up something that's causing my mind to turn around. Maybe this is a good project. Whether or not there is some action that is short of whistleblowing that gets the consent of the affected parties
is appropriate to this case. And my instincts tell me it is.
We now we have like the consumer reports. So if a car is produced and it's really unsafe, that word gets out, and when people buy cars, they can consult the consumer report and see how unsafe it is. So maybe that's the correction on something like this.
Why don't you give us some thought? Everybody give us some thought. I think this requires a little thought. I don't know that anybody has thought of that one before. I've not seen anything on it. I do know that, let's put it this way, there is, what you're really bringing up is you're suggesting that there is a continuum somewhere between whistleblowing and what they call public understanding of engineering. And that's a formal term. There's an office at the National Academy of Engineering called Public Understanding of Engineering. There's an office at the National Academy of Sciences called Public Understanding of Science. And so a person could inform them, you might say. Okay. Which is not... I don't know if this is the same thing as blowing. I haven't given this thought. I don't know who has given it thought. My instincts tell me nobody's given it thought. Because I would have read it by now. So give it some thought. And even if you don't come up with a conclusion, if you come up with some more questions or comments as the course goes along, throw them in. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
When I don't know the book is there, but I read the piece a little bit of this issue of 21 miles per hour. It says something about 20 miles per hour was some sort of other regulation that means that there was some maybe federal standard of some sort that said 20 miles an hour.
They passed the 20 mile per hour test, but in 2 years there was gonna be a new standard that was 21 miles per hour, and it didn't pass.
A standard?
Is that a federal standard?
Yeah.
That
was a federal standard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was not a professional engineering standard. Yeah. There are two things I can say on it, and probably whatever you have in mind, if you have a thought on this, put it on the table. We'll probably buy it. You're in a case almost like this Nuremberg case. You know, somebody guilty of a crime before the act was made a crime. Okay, if they performed the act before it was made a crime, that's one. Then there's another one that I want to bring up in this class. I was talking, we got to get out of here, but I was talking to somebody and let me give you some, do we have an assignment? We still have to do the two nuclear cases. So that's your assignment. We still have to do Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. Okay, so that's next time. This is Thursday. All right. Let me do that. And then let me put this, if I have time, put this other issue on the board. Okay. I want everybody to read this book. Now, I'm going to give you a month to do it. let me see. A month. Where would a month put us? How about 3 weeks? Because the first 50 pages is going to be like reading Shakespeare. It's going to be a little laborious. That's why I'm giving you a lot of time. But after that, it rolls right on out. Right out. Today is the 9th. What about April 1st?
April
Oh, okay. Why not the first class after spring break? So that April 1st is Saturday, so that will be April 4th. Okay. I'm gonna give you the. Okay. Now, it's important to get the spelling right because there is Parzival. And it's by Wolfram von Eschenbach. And I would like for you to get, there's more than one translation. And the translations are different. But I would like for you to get the one that's Penguin Classic. It's one of the Penguin Classics. And this particular translator is named Hatto, A-T-T-A-O. The main reason for choosing Hatto is to choose one so that we have the same one because the translations will vary. Okay, so get that one and we'll discuss it first class after the spring break. The first 50 pages, don't be put off. It's like reading Shakespeare the first time. It's a little bit, you know, I'm going to just open a page at random. There was a heathen named Phlegetonus, who was highly renowned for his acquirements. The same Physicus was descended from Solomon. Don't worry about Physicus. You'll get it, okay? In other words, don't even look for a dictionary. Just read this author's foreword. He'll tell you how to get through this book. And after this, it'll knock your socks off. If you get Parzival mixed up with Parsifal, P-A-R-S-I-F-A-L. It's the same mythical character. Pretty much the same story, but different. Very different. Parsifal is Parsifal is the name of a great German opera. He's one of the characters, and Lohengrin is his son. That's a whole different thing. It's been turned around. Then there's Percival. Same knight. Pretty much, in other words, a Venn diagram. These are overlapping stories. A lot in the middle is the same, but there's a lot on the edges that are different. Percival is the same knight in King Arthur's Round Table as Parsifal, but the stories tell it differently a little bit. But I want you to read that one, and by the time you've finished it, we will start, and I do have time to do this. That what we have done. So far is that we've looked at in the Greek tradition, we've looked at consequentialist approaches,
at least one consequentialist approach, one non-consequentialist approach, or principled approach, or deontological approach. Then we're going to look at virtue, ethics, and under that we're going to look at narrative ethics. And then, actually, what I'm going to do, this gets a little complicated, this narrative ethics is going to be non-Greek. Okay. And then we're going to remember the two paintings. We had the school at Athens. All of this is in the school of Athens, except this one. This one goes out and does something else. Then we're going to go look at the painting, which is the Mass at Bolsena. And we're going to look at Roman point of view. And we're going to look at all of these cases, but through the lens of codes of ethics. We're going to go back to each one of these cases and see what the code has, some code has to say about it. So that will be towards the end, and I do not plan to spend a whole lot of time on this. But I plan to spend a whole lot of time on this, a whole lot of time on this, not so much on this, not so much on that, but a whole lot of time on that. And when we start doing the narrative ethics, we will need characters from mythology, and we'll have at least one mythology that we can all anchor ourselves on. And I would like to have some other mythologies. And it would be fun for you to read some mythologies from some cultures that you don't know anything about. Or if you know something about them, let's make sure they're not Western. Okay? Well, that's it for today. Thank you.